So let me start the conversation by joining a couple of things that we've already talked about today. So the Shadow Treasurer was asked, about growth and in a sense, how people are connecting to growth and the growth experience. This is something that CETA explored last year when we did our Community Pulse research. And the really stark fact that came out of that research was the very small proportion of people in our community who feel that they have directly benefited from economic growth. And those who claimed that they felt that they had greatly benefited from 27 years of economic growth totaled 5% of the population. 5%. So that begged the question, of course, well, who has benefited? Right? Very, very stark response. Big business and senior executives at big business. That's who everyone thinks has enjoyed the benefits of 27 years of record economic growth. And we know that this is just a constant theme, not just in Australia, but elsewhere. The system's broken, the system's, favouring certain sectors, big business over small, business over individuals, et cetera, et cetera. And it sits right at the core of this trust conversation. Now, if I can just add one more piece of information that's sort of come out recently that maybe surprised people a little bit, was the results of the Edelman Trust Barometer, which showed that there was an increase in trust amongst employees for their employers. So a sort of a perverse uptick for some in terms of, essentially trust in business, right? And what the Edelman sort of report concluded was that, in fact, there is an appetite in the community for business as employers to be weighing in on big policy debates and public and societal discussions to a far greater extent than they are. So I think there is just this sort of really interesting set of circumstances at the moment that we're trying to unravel ourselves and to try to understand, as I think all of us are keen to get to a better place in understanding what the right policy reforms are, how we think about the structure of our economy, and how we make sure that everyone feels that they're benefiting from the prosperity that's generated by a strong business sector and a strong economy. So that's my sort of intro. So let me turn first to you, Megan, and let me ask you, as a new person in your role, how are you framing up this issue of trust? And when people say to you, is it realistic that we start, that business can rebuild trust, and how are they going about that? And what is the role of, formal governance and governance processes?
Fantastic. Thanks, Melinda. And, of course, being an absolute expert in week six on the job, I'm very, very happy to answer, of course. The Governance Institute also has what we call our Ethics Index, and so that's a long-running study of ethics in organisations and our understanding of ethics across organisations. And I just wanted to take you through a couple of the results of last year's 2018's Ethics Index. The first is, and these are headline articles, if you like. The first is, of course, trust is important in our society. We have a high representation of people across the business and the survey community that we surveyed, and trust is important, but the trust deficit is high. So that's the bit that we all intuitively know. We think it's really important to be trusted, but we don't trust our major institutions. So that very much reflects the Edelman Barometer. And interestingly, that is it holds true cross-generationally. So trust is just as important to the different generations, and the trust deficit is just as deep within each of the generations. So that's really important, because we often have an assumption that different generations will respond to institutional trust in a different way. Our mistrust is fairly universal. Of course, it is heightened for some sectors of the economy, and in particular, the banking and financial services sector has seen a fabulous dip in trust, and we don't need to ask any questions why. But pretty universally across our traditional institutions, trust has dropped. Now, funnily enough, that doesn't mean that trust in all institutions has dropped. Just our formal institutions. I reflect on the Uber experience. 50 years ago, you were told not to get into a car with a stranger. And then taxis came along and we happily got into a car with a stranger with a certain colour car and a thing on the roof. And now in these days, we plug our personal address into an app so that a stranger through technology can come to our home, our place of residence, and pick us up and take us somewhere else. And that can all be tracked through an institution. So isn't it funny how trust has transferred from our traditional institutions to our networks? The sharing economy is another piece of evidence of this, beyond Uber. The fact that we have Airbnb and we're happy for complete strangers to come and live in our house and rifle through our drawers. So trust is certainly still there. It has just dissipated from our traditional institutions through to our non-formal institutions. Really importantly, in going to what you were saying about our lack of trust in big business and in executives of those big businesses. One of the things that came out in our ethics index is that we feel that the board and the CEO are the biggest influencers of trust within organisations. And yet, CEOs and boards are not the most trusted people within organisations. They are usurped by company secretaries and CFOs by and large. So one of the things that we need to do is to figure out how CEOs and how boards can reinstate that trust. Now, interestingly, when you look at that in comparison to the Edelman barometer that's come out, one of the things that employees are finding is that they trust their leaders when they take the lead on social issues. For example, we look at Alan Joyce with the Yes debate. We look at the business community's response to climate change, including the big energy companies who are taking a far and away larger step towards mitigation activity and towards carbon neutral activity than governments are allowing for in the current policy malaise. So when organisations take that leap and move outside of just the agency theory of return to shareholders only, but think about the return that they need to make to internal and external stakeholders, and that would extend to the broader community and their role within broader society, that's when employee trust tends to spike.
It's really interesting because I think one way that that I reconciled employees sort of saying that you're wanting their employers to have more of a voice was that employees probably have a better chance of understanding whether what's being said is authentic or not, because they, you know, they have some visibility of the person, they'll have some visibility of the culture in the organisation, but they'll also understand whether what's being proposed aligns with the business, which of course the rest of us outside of the business probably are less able to do. So that was one way that I sort of reconciled it, was what they're saying is they feel perhaps a bit more confident that they will be able to judge whether this is, you know, a reasonable, authentic and genuine, foray, or whether it's just a bit of a PR push. Dan, let me just change tack a little bit. One of the things that I find really interesting, and possibly this is because I sit on a board and occasionally I do confront institutional investors and their sharp questions, is the role of investors in this whole conversation, in driving change and in reflecting community expectations. And we've seen some of that. We've seen episodes of it, particularly overseas, in terms of activist shareholders. But how is the industry shaping its thinking around the potential influence that it has, and how is it grappling with trying to get its hands on these important concepts of culture and measurements of trust within organisations and in the governance structures of those organisations?
Thanks very much. And in fact, it actually was one of the key reasons that I wanted to join an organisation like First State Super, because there are some real shifts occurring that you can see right across the industry of the effect that asset owners, asset managers are beginning to have, and the ability to either use that as a force for good or a force for evil. And there's a real balance to be struck here, right? Because you actually see a lot of institutional investors and asset owners are often... It's often viewed that they're often a culprit behind this short-termism and focus on the next quarterly return, etc. So you've got that one side. But on the other side, you've actually got some asset owners, like some of the large super funds, like First State Super, that actually take that responsible ownership really seriously. And the degree of focus on ESG, the degree of debate and the rigour, but also knowing that there's a balance to be struck, because at the end of the day, we are here to provide the best return for members. But if we're able to do that and be a force for good, that's all the much better. So you'll see certainly players like ourselves, for example, take the lead on, for example, divesting from tobacco. So First State Super was one of the first to divest from tobacco. That then had a ripple effect across other super funds, and before you know it, actually became a global phenomenon, which was just fabulous to see real leadership here in Australia. I think you're beginning to see that happen through climate change as well. So you saw yesterday's announcement with Glencore, for example, capping their coal production. And that really, one of the impetuses of that was the Climate Action 100 Plus group, of which First State Super is a major participant in, both having really good and robust conversations with the likes of Glencore, but also plenty of other organisations, whether that be BHP, Origin, Santos, for example, that actually recognises they've got a job to be done. And it's not like, you know, flicking a switch overnight, but actually that there is a real issue and we need to solve that over time. And so that, I think, is actually a really positive and responsible form of ownership, and where I think you'll see more and more of that occur in the future.
So we will turn to questions from the floor. As always, raise your hand, someone will come with the microphone, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But again, while I'm waiting for people to get themselves excited and give us the toughest question of the day, Megan, I think one of the things that we're grappling with is the role of formal rules and policies and processes and regulations in bolstering governance and then ultimately trust, as distinct from the softer issues around principles and culture and all the rest of it. And I think there is, I think you need both. But it feels to me like the momentum has turned, at least now, towards more of a focus on the sort of the black letter. And when you were talking about, you know, who has trust within organisations, and you talked about the company secretary and the CFO, I mean, the interesting thing about those roles is that they do have pretty firm rule books that they follow in terms of their conduct, and also incredible transparency. The production of annual reports, which are scrutinised by external auditors, and et cetera, et cetera. So in some ways you could say, well, gosh, that trust comes from those disciplines. What's your view on it, and how do we, can we walk and chew gum, and how do we get that balance right?
Yeah, and it does go both ways. People often say to me, now that I'm the CEO of Governance Institute, and they say, what exactly is governance? And look, really informally, it's governance, first of all, is your rules and processes with which you run yourself as a company. But like anything, the concept of governance is progressing. It's not a static concept. And certainly, as we've seen with the Hayne Royal Commission and some of the recommendations regarding the foray into ethics and culture and the responsibility of governance systems to respond to those issues, I think that we will see a broadening of the concept of governance to be your external rules and procedures, i.e. how you relate to regulators and legislation and so forth, your internal policies and procedures, the rules with which you choose to run yourself as a company, but also looking at that really important piece of culture. And it's a really difficult one for boards, because traditionally the mantra has been noses in, fingers out. And so it's a really difficult one for boards to grapple with. Well, how do we influence culture? How do we set the tone at the top, which is the other often used phrase, and yet maintain the differential between governance and management? And I think it comes from really applying the systematic sets of rules with which you would have your internal processes pervaded through, and applying those to the way that you rigorously test your alignment of your principles, your values, your ethics systems, and therefore the cultures that you accept in your organisation. So it is things like making sure that individual KPIs reflect appropriately non-financial elements in terms of living the company values. So driving those through financial systems and the reward systems in organisations. I've been very fortunate to work with the Male Champions of Change program, and one of the things I've been reflecting on is one of the elements of the Male Champions of Change program is a thing called the Leadership Shadow, and it's essentially a 360-degree performance assessment of yourself where you ask yourself some deep questions, but also you ask others to reflect on the answers to those questions. And it's all about aligning the values that you're purporting with regards to, in the Champions of Change case, your desire to have more gender equality and female participation and promotion in your organisation. But we can apply those to other areas of those intangible ethics and cultural elements. So I think it's really important when you've got your ethics up on the wall or your value system up on the wall that you have a look at your own behaviours and the subconscious bias that we have all in individuals have and all organisations and the institutional bias that we have in our organisations, and to have a look if they align properly through the acts and the procedures and the rules. So the Leadership Shadow asks leaders to ask four basic questions of themselves. If gender is important to me, how is that reflected by what I do, what I say, what I reward, and what I prioritise? Where do I put my time? And I think that if more boards asked of themselves as individuals and then of their senior executive to ask those same questions and reflect on that a little bit more, then they could see if they're living those values as opposed to the disconnect that we are unfortunately seeing a lot of the time. So yes, it's difficult. It doesn't mean that we should shy away from addressing culture and ethics through governance frameworks. It's just that those frameworks will be slightly different from the regulatory burden of potentially dealing with regulators in a more insistent way.
Can I just add probably two things that I'd say? Look, I really welcome this. Really understanding the cultural drivers right throughout an organisation and ensuring that there's congruence there is so important part of governance. And I don't think it can overstep the sort of management versus oversight. But probably the two things that I would say in regards to it, one is from a governance perspective, are you ensuring that there's congruence to the culture and the values you're setting up? What I mean by that is there is no organisation I've walked into that doesn't say we put our customers first and we are one team. I have not walked into one of them. But if you just leave that with policies and ticking the box and making sure that that is what's discussed at board level versus actually really testing for congruence through things like being out, seeing how the effect we're having on members, on customers, seeing what is being said in complaints, customer feedback, buddying, those sorts of things, you actually get a real sense is what's being said here, and being said here. And are they all congruent to the real culture and the values that we want? And I just think there actually has not been enough attention paid to those types of dimensions versus, you know, have we got the right policies and procedures? They really are minimum, and I think that we'll see much more of a shift of, are we setting high enough standards and is there congruence throughout the organisation? And I think that's what the community is crying out for.
We've got a question over here on the right.
Hi, it's Frankie Muscovich from the Property Council of Australia. Question for the panel, but very pleased to see Megan up there in your new role. I wanted to ask a question about, growing expectation that business has a stance on particular issues. So I want to test that with you on whether those issues relate to areas where there's a failure in leadership from governments specifically or exclusively, or whether, there are other factors at play. And the second part of my question is, a lot of industries are looking at the Banking Royal Commission and, appropriately having a good look at their own industries. What are some of the conversations that you have with investors, and which industries need to be really worried about their culture?
I'll have a shot first. Thanks, Frankie. Good to see you. So the first part of your question was, is it incumbent upon the business community to step forward in some of these social debates? And the question is to whether policy and politics are failing us somewhat. And I'd have to say, yes, it's very true. I think that we've seen this across a range of issues. Climate change in particular, and response to climate change, comes to mind. The building sector has massively taken the lead in terms of a market-driven system in terms of a response, but we're seeing it right across different industries these days. And the Shadow Treasurer this morning, he's right. It's because investments in energy are long-term. They need a certainty of trajectory. They need a certainty of policy outcome. And we're simply not seeing it. When we look at the changeover of prime ministers, of the dismantling internally in parties, of the oscillation between the parties over the last 20 years, we just can't sit around and wait for there to be policy certainty. And so the business community is clearly stepping forward and setting those long-term targets for themselves. In terms of a broader range of social issues, I think the business community is also stepping forward because they're understanding that what is good for the cohesion of society is good for business, it's good for long-term economic growth, and therefore it's the tide that raises all boats. And so, yes, you fight for market share amongst your competitors in your particular sector, and you will try and institute those things that will raise your internal productivity and profit performance. But I think there is a broader recognition that we need to deal with, for example, the feeling of inequity of the sharing of the productivity and economic growth that we've had over the last 27 odd years. Unless we can tackle those issues and bring society along with us, then we're really going to be fighting over pieces of the pie rather than increasing the pie over the long term. So absolutely, politics is failing us somewhat at the moment. It gives rise to a sense of the need for new democratic systems to make decisions, whether it's policy by wiki or the dealing with disruption with regulators or a whole bunch of other things. We've seen some really great results, for example, with citizens' juries for policy making as opposed to it being left to the politicians. So I think there's some really great opportunities for us, but business is absolutely needing to and will take the lead.
I would probably add two things to your two questions. Thank you for them, Frankie. One is where you said, you know, should we, for example, CEOs have a voice to all social issues? What I would say is, this is, I actually think, a really sensitive area in the community, and I would say that actually in determining where you have the right to have a voice in a social issue, I think is a combination of clarity of your purpose, so why the organisation is there, and clarity of what your stakeholders, in particular your customers, your employees and the community that you serve, really care about. And then absolutely, I think in today's day and age, you are expected there to actually have a real voice at the table from that perspective. So that's sort of what I use as the way of guiding of whether I should or should not have a view that is publicly aired. So that's certainly the first one. The second one, as it relates to the Banking Royal Commission, something near and dear to my heart, and its relevance for other industries, well, I would say all industries. So I would go back to two really critical things that Hain pointed out in his preamble before he went through the recommendations. One is he commented the fact that in just about every case of misconduct, there was an absolute maniacal focus on profit, but also on self-interest, personal gain. So that's number one. And that isn't just a financial service issue. That is a leadership issue, actually, I would say, in terms of ego, self-interest over humility and serving the community that you represent. So that's number one. And the second point that he actually brought up, which we've already discussed, is ultimately he said, view all of these recommendations and misdeeds in the light of the number one fact is that the misconduct was should be seen at the hands of the board and senior management, and that the buck stops there. And I think that when you think about that, there is relevance across many industries as to the governance and the leadership of industries. So whilst I think the banking and financial services sector is certainly in the spotlight with the Royal Commission, I think those themes are very applicable across all industries.
Can I just weigh in on this too? I just think it's absolutely incumbent on every board and every business to be reflecting on the lessons that have been learned from this. I think the challenge is that there has been an immediate reaction where every board is looking at the findings and trying to, reflecting on. Every board will have seen, APRA's report into the CBA. Every board will be considering Hayne and what does it mean for us, as it should. I think the challenge is to do that in a way where you're stepping back and you are asking yourselves genuinely, what does this mean for us? Not just, oh, they didn't do this, they didn't do that, right, tick, tick, tick. Yes, we need a new chief risk officer. Yes, we need this new risk process. Yet, and I think that's the challenge in all of this. And so I think all of these opportunities should be used as a way to have a conversation about at a board and in the senior leadership team around what are the messages we take from this. Let's use this as an honest questioning of where we're at. And then if I can join the dots on what the lessons learned from Hayne and social engagement, for me, and I've said this before on a Governance Institute stage, is that I think what the community is telling business is that they expect to be heard. And that business needs to demonstrate that it is listening to its stakeholders, whether it's its employees or its consumers or people in the wider community. It is listening, it is hearing, it is responding to those issues, and then it is showing people how it is responding. And if it doesn't matter whether that's customer policy, it doesn't matter whether it's environmental impact, and it doesn't matter whether it's a social issue that's important to your community or your employees, if you do that, then I think you have authenticity and right to play. But if you don't do that, you'll be found out. Question over here.
Yeah, thanks, Melinda. Ann Smith from First State Super. Fascinating discussion. It's very nuanced and very broad-ranging. I'd like to bring this back up to the community level, and it goes to the heart of all the things you've been talking about, Royal Commissions, bad treatment of individuals and bad products and processes and outcomes across the board in many sectors, not just ours. I think when I hear the discussion, the things that are coming to mind for me are fairness, transparency and participation. Be interested in your comments on how we can, as a community, overcome things like the sharing of water in the water systems that we're hearing about at the moment, but also, more than that, how we get to move things quickly to get better outcomes in this space of trust.
I'll kick that off. I think the first and foremost lesson that we absolutely have to take note of is that through Hayne and through a number of upcoming Royal Commissions, make no mistake, the bar for governance is lifted and it is not going to go anywhere but up. The requirement, given shareholder activism, given the transparency that social media brings and the immediacy to issues that social media brings, given the breakdown of the hierarchy of communication and information, there is no doubt that the bar has been raised. The issue then for businesses is to figure out how to respond to that heightened bar and how to make sure that those elements of fairness and consistency and whatnot are applied through organisations. Now, the great but also challenging thing about governance is that it is not pursued through necessarily hard and fast rules. Every organisation can govern itself in the way that it sees fit. There is no, this is the standard agenda, this is the standard minutes, this is the standard risk register. There is no such thing as those standards because every organisation must look within itself to create those internal standards. What we can do is assist organisations, and I fear particularly for many organisations in Australia that have no comprehensive, many family businesses, a lot of not-for-profits, filled with well-meaning, well-intentioned individuals who have absolutely no idea of either their regulatory or community-based expectations with regards to governance. So there's absolutely an education lesson that needs to occur with respect to anyone who takes up a director or officer position in any sorts of organisations. But there's the great thing that we can do through governance training is create frameworks for the right questions for you to ask yourself to set your own parameters in place. So once again, asking questions like not just can we do this, but should we do this? If that question is not being asked at every meeting of every board in Australia from here henceforth forward, then there is a problem that we have not learned through Hain. So I think to create a framework for the questions that you should be consistently asking of yourself as an organisation that go to the ethics and fairness and community expectations in the same way that you have rigour around the questions that you ask of your financials every single month.
And Anne, probably two other things that I'd add. One of them you answered it yourself, which is transparency. I think the greater organisations can show transparency, whether that's reporting their view, what they're doing around climate change, what they're doing around gender diversity, what they're doing. That transparency, I think, helps lift the bar and provides complete view to the market as to how they're doing. The second one is, I think, what you were touching on, which is really around, and this can happen fast, but it's very different to how a lot of organisations are organised today, is are you well equipped to actually understand community expectations and have the voice of the customer heard? And I mean really heard, not just, well, we do a few surveys and that sort of bubbles up and we see an overall NPS or customer sat. I mean, do you really understand the issues of the day of your community and your customers? And that actually can happen quite rapidly, but it's actually more the current management and board well equipped to understand that. And actually, I think that that also brings in an issue of board diversity. And I don't mean just diversity of gender. I actually do mean, is your board and management team diverse enough that they themselves represent the community and understand the community? And I think if you looked at a lot of boards in Australia, the answer would be no. That's not a short-term fix, though. That's a longer-term fix. But I think diversity of board is also an issue that would help address community expectations.
I could just go on and on and on about that topic, but unfortunately, unfortunately for you, we can't. It is lunchtime. What a great conversation. I'm fairly certain that this is a conversation that we will be having again in many different ways, shapes and forms, because there is a lot to be talked about and a lot to be progressed. But thank you, Deanne. Thank you, Megan. It's great to have you here contributing to this event and to CEDA more broadly. So it's lunchtime. We'll be back. I keep having to scroll through my list and find the next time, which is... I can't find it. 1:15? Nods from the table. 1:15. We'll be back. Thank you very much.
Thanks.